Chapter 6. Around the Houses. Walking steadily along the road to Lanker, with Mephistopheles trotting beside him, and his little cart rattling behind, and swallows swooping overhead, Geoffrey realised that his old home seemed a long way away now. It had only been a week or so, but as they climbed higher into the ramtops, he began to understand what geography meant in reality, rather than in the books Mr. Wiggle had let him read. Lanker and its surrounding villages had a lot of geography. At the end of a day's long but satisfying walk for both boy and goat, they arrived outside a village pub, which proclaimed its name as The Star, the sign promising excellent ales and food. Well, let's see how excellent it is, Geoffrey thought. He unhitched the cart and went into the pub with the goat following close behind. The pub was full of working men, who were now not working but enjoying a pint or two before dinner. It was rather stuffy inside, with the usual rural tint of agricultural armpit. The regulars were used to people bringing a working dog in with them, but they were amazed to see a dusty but well-dressed lad bringing a goat into their pub. The rather skinny barman said, "We only allow dogs in here, mister." All eyes in the pub were by now focused on Mephistopheles, and Geoffrey said, "My goat is cleaner and more knowledgeable than any dog. He can count to 20, and when the time comes, he'll go outside to do his business. In fact, sir, if I can show him your privy now, he will use it when he needs it." One worker appeared to take umbrage at this point. "Do you think that just because we work on the land, we don't know nothing? I have a pint here that says that the goat can't do it." Innocently, Geoffrey said, "You have a knowledgeable pint there, sir," and everyone in the pub laughed. Now every eye was on Geoffrey as he said, "Mephistopheles, how many people are in this pub?" The goat looked down his nose, and it was a nose a dowager would have been proud of, at the men around the bar and started his count, delicately hitting the floor with his hoof, the noise suddenly being the only sound in the place. He hit the floor 8 times. "He got it right," declared the barman.
"I saw something like that afore," said one of the men. "There were a travelling show, you know, clowns and tightrope walkers and folk with no arms and travelling doctors.
There was the usual man who puts weasels down his trousers in action too, hence the need for a doctor.
They called it a carnival, and they had a horse they said could count, but it was just a trick."
Geoffrey smiled and said, "If a couple of you gentlemen would care to step out for a moment, I will ask my goat to do it again, and you will see that there is no trick involved." Intrigued now, several of the men stepped out while the others started to take bets amongst themselves. "Gentlemen, my goat will tell you how many people are still in the room," said Geoffrey. Once again, daintily, Mephistopheles tapped out the correct number. Hearing the cheers, the men who had gone out came back in again looking curious, and Mephistopheles' hoof registered each one as he entered. The barman laughed.
"This trick deserves a meal for you and your remarkable goat, mister. What does he like?"
"It's no trick, I assure you, but thank you. Mephistopheles will eat almost anything. He's a goat. Some scraps would be most acceptable. And for myself, just some bread would be welcome." A bowl of kitchen scraps was produced for Mephistopheles, and Geoffrey sat down beside him with his pint and a slab of bread and butter, chatting to some of the men who were interested in the goat. An interest which only deepened when Mephistopheles went out in the direction of the privy and after a while came back again.
"You actually managed to get him to do that?" said one of them in wonder.
"Yes," said Geoffrey. "I trained him from when he was very small. He's quite docile, really. Well, if I'm around."
"What do you mean?"
"It means he does what he's told, but he has a mind of his own as well. I wouldn't lose him for anything." Just then there were raised voices at the other end of the bar as one drinker, filled with the bluster that ale can give to a man, started a fight with someone else who had just come in. The more sensible people moved away as the two began to trade blows, seemingly intent on beating one another to death, while the barman bellowed about the damage to his furniture and threatened to wallop them with his grandfather's knobkerry, a souvenir from the Clatchian campaign, if they didn't stop. Mephistopheles was suddenly alert at Geoffrey's side, and every drinker who was sober understood in his soul that this was no time to be unpleasant to the lad. They didn't know how they knew, but there was a kind of visceral power there waiting to be unleashed. "Why are they fighting? What's wrong?" Geoffrey asked his neighbour.
"An old grudge about a young lady," said the man, rolling his eyes. "A bad business. Someone's going to get hurt, you mark my words."
To everyone's astonishment, Geoffrey strolled across the pub, his goat watching his every step, dodged the wildly swinging blows, and stood between the two men, saying, "There's no need to fight, you know." The barman's face fell. He knew what happened to people who tried to get between two idiots smelling blood. And then he could hardly believe his eyes, for the two men abruptly stopped fighting and were standing there looking rather bemused. "Why don't you two just meet the young lady and see what she thinks before you start beating each other to death?" Geoffrey said softly. The men looked at one another, and the bigger of the two said, "He's right, you know." And the pub audience laughed as the two men looked around at the wreckage, seemingly amazed that this could have had anything to do with them. "There, that was easy, wasn't it?" said Geoffrey, returning to the bar. "Ah!" said the landlord, astonished that he wasn't having to pick a battered Geoffrey off the floor. "You're not a wizard, are you?" "No," said Geoffrey. "It's a knack. It happens to me all the time when I need it," he smiled. "Mostly with animals and sometimes with people. But alas," he thought to himself, "not with my father. Never with him." "Well, you must be some kind of wizard," said the barman. "You've broken up a fight between two of the nastiest bruisers we have around here." He glared at the two miscreants. "As for you two," he said, "don't come back here until you are sober. Look at the mess you've made." He grabbed both of them and pushed them out of the door. The rest of the drinkers got back to their pints. The barman turned back to Geoffrey and looked at him in shrewd appraisal. "You want a job, lad? No pay, but you get your keep." "I can't take a job, but I'd be happy to stay for a few days," said Geoffrey with alacrity. "If you can find some vegetables for me, I eat no meat. And can there be a place for Mephistopheles as well? He's not very smelly." "Probably no worse than the people we have in here," said the barman, laughing. "I tell you what, you and your goat can stay in the barn, and I'll give you your dinner and breakfast, and then after that we'll see." The man held out a rather dirty hand. "A deal, then?" "Oh, yes, thank you. My name is Geoffrey." The man hesitated. "My name's Darling. Darling Dove." He looked at Geoffrey mournfully and said, "Have a laugh about it, will you? Everyone does. Might as well get it out of the way." "Why?" said Geoffrey. "Darling is a kind word, and so is Dove. How can these be anything to worry about?" That night, Mr. Dove told his wife, "I got us a new barboy. Funny cove he is too, but he seems, well, harmless. Sort of easy to talk to." "Can we afford it, Darling?" his wife said. "Oh," said Darling Dove, "he just wants feeding. Doesn't even want meat, and somewhere to sleep. And he's got a goat. Quite a smart one, really. Does tricks and all. Might bring some more customers in." "Well, dear, if you think it's a good idea." "What are his clothes like?" asked Mrs. Dove. "Pretty good," said Mr. Dove. "And he talks like a toff. I wonder if he is running away from something. Best not to ask any questions, I reckon. I'll tell you what, though, between him and his goat, we won't have any trouble in the bar." And indeed, Geoffrey stayed at the Star for 2 days, simply because Mr. Dove liked him hanging around the place. And Mrs. Dove said she was sad when he told her husband that he had to move on. "A strange boy, young Geoffrey. He kind of gives me the idea that everything is all right, even if I don't know what it is that is right. A sort of rightness, floating in the air. I'm really sorry that he's going," she said. "Yes, dear," said Mr. Dove. "I asked him to stay, I really did, but he said he must go to Lanka." "That's where they have the witches," said his wife. She made a face. "Well," Mr. Dove said, "that's where he wants to go." He paused and added, "He said, the wind is blowing him there." Battling into a bitter headwind on her long journey back to her parents' farm, Tiffany felt that there was altogether too much wind in and around Lanka. Still, at least it wasn't raining, she told herself. Yesterday's rain had been awful, the kind of joyous rain where every cloud had decided to join the party once one cloud had cracked open the first deluge. She had felt proud of having the two steadings at first, flying between Lanka and the chalk every few days, but broomsticks are not very fast. Or warm. It gets awfully cold up there, and no sensible witch ever took to the skies without several layers of flannelette between her and the stick. It was good that she could go back home to where her mother did the cooking, but even back home there was no time to rest, and being away in Lanka for half the week meant she was facing a plethora of demands from the chalk. People weren't getting nasty about it. After all, she was a witch, and Lanka had more people than the chalk. But there were these little strains beginning to develop. A few mutters. And she had a horrible feeling that some of the muttering was coming from other witches. Witches who were finding cues at their doors, people who had gone to find Granny Weatherwax and just found an empty cottage. Some of the problem in both steadings was with the old men left behind when their wives had died. A lot of them didn't know how to cook. Occasionally, some of the old ladies would help, and you would see them carrying a pot of stew round for the old man next door. But the witch part of Tiffany couldn't help but notice that this happened more often if the old lady was a widow and the old man had a nice cottage and a bit of money put by. There was always something that had to be done, and some days it seemed mostly to be about toenails. There was one old man in Lanka, a decent old boy, whose toenails were as sharp as a lethal weapon, and Tiffany had to ask Jason Ogg, a blacksmith, to make her a pair of secateurs tough enough to break through them. She always closed her eyes until she heard the patter of his toenails banging off the ceiling. But the old man called her his lovely lady and tried to give her money, and at least she now knew that the Feagles had a use for the toenail clippings. Witches liked useful things, Tiffany mused, as she tried to take her mind off the chill wind whipping around her. A witch would never have to ask for anything. Oh, no, no one wanted to owe a witch anything, and a witch didn't take money either. Instead, she accepted things she could make use of, food, and old clothing, and bits of cloth for bandages, and spare boots. Boots. She had tripped over Granny Weatherwax's boots again that very day. She had put them in the corner of the room now, and there they sat, almost staring at her when she was too weary to think. "You're not good enough yet to fill these boots," they seemed to say. "You'll have to do a lot more first." Of course, there always was such a lot to do. So many people never seemed to think about the consequences of their everyday actions. And then a witch on her broom would have to set out from her bed in the rain at the dead of night because of "I only" and its little friends "I didn't know" and "It's not my fault." "I only wanted to see if the copper was hot. I didn't know a boiling pot was dangerous. It's not my fault no one told me dogs that bark might also bite." And her favourite, "I didn't know it would go off bang," when it said "goes bang" on the box it came in. That had been when little Ted Cooper had put an explosive banger, another tiny clue, into the carcass of a chicken after his mum's birthday party and nearly killed everybody around the table. Yes, she had bandaged and treated everybody, even the Joker, but she hoped very much his dad had kicked his ass afterwards. And when the witch wasn't there, well, what harm was there in trying out a few things for yourself? Most people knew about using plants to cure things. They were certain about that. But the thing about plants is that many of them look like all the others. And so Mistress Holland, wife of the Miller of the Chalk, had treated her husband's unfortunate skin condition with Love Lies Oozing rather than with Medi-Day Root, and now his skin had turned purple. Tiffany had treated the man, but then it had been time for her to go back to Lanka, and she was up and away again on her stick, hoping that they had both learned their lesson. She was very thankful that Nanny Ogg was not too far away from Granny's, no, her, cottage. There were a lot of things that Tiffany was good at, but cookery wasn't one of them, and so, just as she relied on her mum and dad for meals in the Chalk, in Lanka she relied on Nanny. Strictly speaking, this meant she was relying on Nanny's army of daughters-in-law, who couldn't do enough for their old Nanny. Enough wasn't really a long enough word to describe the numerous little tasks any young woman marrying into the Ogg family found were expected of her. But wherever the pair of them took their meals, either in Tiffany's little cottage in the woods, or at Tia Nanny Ogg, the overcrowded but very comfortable home where Nanny Ogg ruled the roost, it seemed that you was there too. No cat could move as fast as her, but you never saw her move fast, she just arrived. It was baffling. What was also baffling was how Grebo, Nanny's ancient tomcat, who treated a bit of eyeball scratching as a friendly hello, slunk away when you appeared. The white cat had clearly made her decision and was a constant presence in Tiffany's life in Lanka. Now, when Tiffany got ready for an afternoon of going round the houses, you would jump on the broomstick before Tiffany had even looked at it, which made Nanny laugh, saying, "She's got you down pat, my girl. Maybe she could go round the houses by herself." Nanny Ogg was actually rather impressed by Tiffany, but also worried. "Really," she said to her one day as they shared a quick meal, "you know you're good, Tiff. I know you're good. Granny, wherever she is now, knew you was good. But you don't have to keep trying to do it all on your own, my girl. Let some of them young girls around here, the apprentices, take some of the strain." She paused as she chewed on a big mouthful of stew, then added, "That young lumberjack up in the mountains what Esme sewed up just the day afore she died? Well, young Harriet of Bilk's been going on up there to see to him, and doing a good job too."
"Tiff, you have to do it your own way, I know, but you ain't the only witch in Lanka. Sometimes you needs to put your feet up and let the parade go by."
Tiffany had barely had time to listen before she was back on her stick and heading down to the chalk again. No rest for the busy witch with two steadings. But as the ear-numbing wind whistled by, she considered what Nanny had said. It was true that there were other witches in Lanka, but in the chalk, unless Letitia decided to stop being just a baroness, Tiffany was the only witch. And if her forebodings were right, if Jeannie's words came true, then one witch for the chalk might not be anywhere near enough. She shivered. She was looking forward to getting out of the icy wind and into the warmth of her mother's kitchen. But there was one person she needed to see first. It took Tiffany a long time to find Miss Tick, but eventually she landed in a little wood just outside Hamon Rye, where the travelling witch, the witchfinder, had stopped her caravan for tea. A small mule was tethered nearby, enjoying the contents of its feed bag. It looked at Tiffany as she approached and neighed.
"He's called Joseph," said Miss Tick, "a real witch's mule."
It had started to rain again, and Miss Tick quickly waved Tiffany up the wooden caravan steps. Tiffany was glad to see that there was a kettle bubbling on a little stove. She perched herself on the edge of a bench seat, fitted just inside the door, facing the stove, and gratefully took the offered cup of tea. Inside the caravan it was just as Tiffany expected. Miss Tick had everything shipshape without needing a ship. On the walls were lots of little racks, neatly filled with many things, and all annotated in Miss Tick's careful, teachery hand. Tiffany looked closer, and, yes, they were in alphabetical order. Elsewhere were little pots without labels, so you would never know what was inside them, and by the side of her bed there was a chart showing a variety of knots. Escapology was a useful hobby for a witch.
"I'll be grateful if you don't touch my little jars," said Miss Tick. "Some of those concoctions might not work properly, and the results are often unpredictable. But, you know, one should keep on experimenting."
That's what's in all the pots, thought Tiffany, taking a sip of her tea. Experiments.
"Glad to see you," Miss Tick continued. "I'm hearing about you all the time. You know, almost every girl I meet wants to be you. They see you whizzing about all over the place on your broomstick, and they all want to be you, Mistress Aching. Suddenly, it's becoming a career choice to be a witch."
"Oh, yes," said Tiffany. "That's how it starts out. And then you tell them exactly what they would spend their life doing, and quite a few of them decide to go to the big city and be a hairdresser or something."
"Well, I make no bones about it," said Miss Tick firmly. "I tell them to think hard. It's not all magic and waving wands and all that silly business. It's dirt and grime."
Tiffany sighed. "Being a witch is a man's job. That's why it needs women to do it." Miss Tick laughed and continued, "Well, I remember a little girl who was unsure of herself, and I told her that I would give her lessons that she would never forget in a hurry." Tiffany smiled. "I remember, and now I am in a hurry everywhere these days. But, Miss Tick," she paused and her voice went a bit quiet, "I have a feeling that some of the older witches are beginning to think I might not be able to cope." She swallowed. "Up in Lanka, mostly. But it means I do have to be there a lot." She bit her lip. She hated asking for help. Was she saying that she wasn't really up to the job, letting Granny Weatherwax down, since Granny had been the one to put her name up for it? She couldn't remember Granny ever asking for help. "Down here, on the chalk," she said, "I think I maybe need to, train an apprentice? Have some help?" The heavens didn't open. There was no gasp of horror from the other witch at this request. Miss Tick simply crossed her arms sternly.
"It's Lettice Earwig, I suppose, who's put those doubts into people's heads. She thinks things always have to be done the same way, so that means she would take over, I suppose. She's a senior witch who believes she knows every blessed thing, but it's all just tinkly-winkly stuff. The stupid woman who wrote My Fairy Friends should be ashamed to call herself a witch, and certainly shouldn't hope to walk in the footsteps of Granny Weatherwax. Lettice Earwig certainly couldn't manage two steadings at once. She can't really even cope with one," she snorted derisively. "Do not forget, Tiffany, that I am a teacher,"
said in a way that made everyone listening know this instantly.
"And we teachers can be really nasty when it comes to it.
Ten Steps to Witchcraft and The Romance of the Broomstick are not what I would call proper books. Oh, I'll certainly look out for a girl or two for you. It's a very good idea. But you don't need to worry about what Mrs. Earwig might say. Oh, no.